Welcome to PostStatus Draft, the official podcast for PostStatus, a website with news and information for WordPress professionals. Today, Joe and I talk about WordPress development processes and the tools that we use to get our jobs done. If you enjoy this podcast, you can get a lot more quality news and analysis from the PostStatus Club multiple times per week. Check out current club members, site partners, and join the club on our website at poststatus.com/club. You'll be joining more than 650 wonderful club members, and you'll never miss important WordPress news again. Today, I want to feature one of our partners, Yoast. Yoast SEO gives you 24/7 support from a support team and extra features such as the redirect manager, tutorial videos, and integration with Google Webmaster Tools. Yoast just released version 3.2 of WordPress SEO, and it's got a lot of great new features that you should check out. Thanks to Yoast for being a PostStatus partner, and go to yoast.com for more information. Now here's our show. Hey everybody, I'm Brian, and I'm the editor of PostStatus.
And I'm Joe, a co-founder and the CTO of HumanMate, and welcome to the PostStatus Draft Podcast. And today we're going to be talking about WordPress development tools and processes that we use.
Yeah, so
somehow we haven't talked about this before.
We have not. We did a full podcast on version control and hosting, but not like kind of full on development tools that we use. So we kind of have separated this to process tools, coding and debugging tools, build tools, version control, review and deployment tools, and front end tools and extensions. And there's a lot on our draft list here. So
we may not mention them all. We'll see.
Yeah, we might not mention them all, but we will do our best to list and link as many as we can, and people can, you know, kind of check them out and whatever. But these are tools that we use. It's obviously not all of the tools that exist in the world for development. It's worth noting that some of the stuff that we're mentioning is probably Mac only.
I was thinking about that. I feel kind of bad that half Windows the things people that I use. Yeah, just generally.
just for the fact that they're on Windows.
The trolling has already begun. I just don't... on one hand, I think one of the reasons that I do use a Mac is because I do think the tooling is a lot better. But then again, I haven't had a Windows PC in so long that could be a position of ignorance now.
Yeah, well, that's okay. We'll be ignorant about Windows.
We've acknowledged our ignorance. We can now continue with it.
Right.
That's how it works, right?
So I guess we should just go ahead and get started. But before we do, for people that don't listen to full podcasts, we are notoriously bad about mentioning a day of rest at the time. And I just thought of it. So nice. I'm going to go ahead and do a little pitch for A Day of Rest Boston. That's right. I said Boston.
Is that a pronunciation thing? Is that what you're...
No, because it's not London. A Day of Rest happened in London. A Day of Rest is coming to the United States. It's going to be in Boston. This is a conference all about the WordPress REST API. Joe is one of the lead developers of the REST API, and this conference is going to be great. HumanMade put this on in London, and I was a media partner. This time I'm a full-on co-organizer, meaning I get additional responsibility, which is
additional tasks.
Good and bad. anyway, I'm excited about it. We are actively seeking sponsors right now. So if you've ever wanted to be a partner or sponsor of PostStatus, this is a good opportunity to get involved with something that I'm doing with PostStatus and obviously HumanMade as well. And it's going to be a really fun event. There's going to be workshops this time instead of a hack day. And I'm really excited about that. So it's like half day and full day workshops on using the REST API in real life. The day before the conference, it's going to be for people probably building their first REST API project. The day after the conference, it's going to be for more advanced workshops for people that have done something with the REST API before, and now you're digging in deeper.
That's cool.
So yeah, so be on the lookout on both PostStatus and A Day of Rest .hm for information about A Day of Rest Boston. And with that said,
good job. Well done for
thank
for
you.
Remembering.
Siobhan's not allowed to get upset with me for not mentioning it. And with that, let's go into process tools that we use in our WordPress development flow.
Okay. So I think how we should do this is we should pick our favorites alternate until we've none favorites left. And then we'll move on, maybe.
Yep, that sounds good. I don't even recognize most of the ones you put on here. So,
That's good.
It's going to be a learning experience for me.
All right. Well, I'm going to let you go first on telling me whatever the best tool you have is for anything to do with process.
Well, I want to get the no-brainer out of the way because this is what is kind of my most informative tool. So I know when something happens because of this, and that's Slack. I've integrated Slack into my development process so that when code deploys, the notification goes into Slack and tells me that it has successfully deployed. When certain actions happen on a website, sometimes those trigger Slack notifications as well. Slack is kind of a no-brainer. The other one that I think that I would maybe point out would just be screen capture stuff. So ScreenFlow for video, and then CloudUp for screenshots I use constantly when I'm working in a team environment, especially so that I can better explain what the heck I'm talking about.
I'm going to have to check on CloudUp. So
CloudUp's like Cloud App or Droplr or any of those others.
My only selection criteria with any screen capture upload to the internet app is that it never, ever, ever, ever links to a web page that shows the image. And it has to link directly to the image because I cannot stand it when people share screenshots as actually like a 2 megabyte page with loads of other stuff. So if CloudUp does that, I'm afraid I'm going to have to recommend Captured over it. But I don't actually know if it does.
CloudUp links to a page, not directly to the image. However, you can link directly to the image with the click of one button.
But what does it copy to your clickboard?
You can maybe adjust what it does by default, but it really, like, you click direct URL and it auto copies it to your to your clipboard. The reason I don't mind the web page is because I can apply a password to the image through their little edit screen. This is one of Automattic's best products, in my opinion.
I think Captured is better because, well, for a couple of reasons. Which does the same thing for anybody who doesn't know, but you can, first off, I just have it linked to an S3 bucket, so all of the screenshots that I ever do is just put on my S3 bucket. But the other thing that I like about it, maybe CloudUp works the same, but so on a Mac, you can obviously click Command-Shift-4 and drag over any area of the screen. So I just have Captured bound to Command-Shift-5, and it has exactly the same UI and interaction. So it's just Command-Shift-5, drag over the screen, and then it copies the direct image URL on S3 to your clipboard. So that's the most...
What do you use for that?
That's Captured.
Yeah. Captured?
Yeah. So that's like the least friction one I've ever had, which I like.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. But we're going to go really slow if we spent 3 minutes or whatever on the screenshot tool that we use.
This is very important to me. When somebody shares it, I just go crazy. I'm like, why do you do? I'm like on my like crappy tethering connection and I'm like still downloading the webpage. And then like some of them is like the actual images on the webpage is smaller than the uploaded one. So like you're actually looking at like a downsize and then you got to click it to open the original. Oh man, it just drives me insane.
How do you really feel?
Yeah, no, I'll tell you after a couple of beers one day.
And then you use GitHub to do little GIFs.
Oh, so that's, but that doesn't exist. That's actually a app that I was building. It was just a way for me to do a shameless plug, if you happen to mention that one. It's like a little trap for you. So this is something that I was building. So I decided to learn some Objective-C and make some native apps or whatever. But this one is bound to exactly the same thing. So you do Command-Shift-6 and you draw over any area and it starts recording a video of that area. And then you just hit Command-Shift-6 again when you're done, and again, it does the same thing of like converts it to a GIF and just copies the URL to your clipboard. However, I did run into some issues with trying to get this on the App Store because of like signing binaries for like the Image Magic library, and I don't know. I never got it fully released because of that. But I also emailed GitHub to ask them if I could use the word GitHub, and they said no. So that was another reason why that didn't take off so well.
Well, there are other GIF creation apps.
Exactly.
It's kind of, it's not the easiest thing to do. I found some that you do a video first and then it's a command line thing to do it. But there's one Mac app that I can't remember right now. Chris Coyer tweeted it recently, so go look that up. we got to go faster.
Okay, go. It's my go.
Your turn. Yeah. Please go.
So I'm going to pick Authy. Have you used this?
I don't think so, but it's temporary authentication, maybe?
No, so this is two-factor authentication.
Oh, okay.
But it has, so like usually people have two-factor auth on their phone using Google Authenticator. That's like the most common one I've run into. But this has, so it has an iPhone app, but it also has a desktop app. So you can just open two-factor auth on your desktop. And then it like syncs them between the two. And also if you like wipe your phone and reinstall the app, then Google Authenticator, like if you switch phones, you usually lose all your two-factor auth stuff. For anybody that thinks it's insecure, I don't actually think it is, because like two-factor auth doesn't mean like two devices. It just means two methods of authentication. So if somebody steals your password, even if you have like an application on your app that's doing the two-factor auth code, it still doesn't really, it's no kind of more insecure or whatever. So it's so much easier for me. If I have to log into like AWS console, then I have one password for my password, and then I open Authy on the Mac and copy, and much easier. It means that like I don't mind doing two-factor auth on anything, whereas it used to be a total pain.
Yeah, I always have to open up Google Authenticator in my phone and it annoys me.
Yeah, you should switch to Authy.
Yeah, that's a good one. For a second I thought it was going to be some kind of like OAuth spoofer or something.
So it does sound a bit like it, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. For like development purposes to not actually have to authenticate. Anyway. All right. So my next one is Alfred, which is kind of a replacement for whatever, like Spotlight or whatever that thing is on the Mac.
I use Spotlight now.
Yeah, they adopted some Alfred functionality, but Alfred's still got some pretty cool stuff. But I use Alt Space and I can trigger Alfred. And then I have a custom command where then I do a comma, and it essentially gives me code snippets that I can use. So like, you can, you know, just put like a default WP query or var dump snippet, you know, something like that, to where it saves you a handful of characters, but you can go nuts with this too. Like the same type, you know,
what does it do? So like,
it's like a text expander.
Okay. So like inserts it into the active application that you've got open or something.
Yep. So I can, If I just want a standard loop or something where I don't type it every time, I can do it in three characters because I alt space comma enter, and it gives me the command that I want or the little code snippet.
Okay, that's cool.
Yep, so I like that one. Easy. I just put a var dump in.
Do you use Alfred for anything else apart from launching apps?
Yeah, I use it as my primary calculator, and then I use it for searching for files a lot. I don't use Alfred to the extent that you can use it.
Right.
But yeah, I have done some stuff.
To Spotlight.
I have done some stuff where you kind of like string together actions. I can't remember what they call them, but it's basically a little routine.
Yeah, that's so pretty cool.
If something takes multiple steps.
So one thing that really annoys me about Spotlight is because it does a calculator, right? So I can do like 50 times 50, but you can't press return to copy it to your clipboard, which Alfred does, and it really annoys me that you can't do that in Spotlight. So maybe I should switch just for that.
Maybe. What you got? You don't know.
I'm going to go... Oh, I toss up between Flux or Clocks. I think it's going to be
both
Clocks.
Of them, because I don't think I have any more on process tools. Okay.
So Clocks is a really simple menu bar app that just allows you to like add different cities, and it's got a nice UI for like working out the different time in all the different cities. It's like there's a lot of different things that can do this. Like, there's like a load of websites and stuff, but this is just like a really nicely designed, very simple UI Mac-like kind of interface. It's always just there in your menu bar. You one click and you can see everything, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's cool. I use time.is is a website that.
Yeah. See, even opening a website for me is too much friction. Like, it's
you can't like, you Command can't be bothered T, to open a website.
Open new. No, yeah, exactly. Command T, open new tab. Is two key presses, and I'm only typing the URL, and then you got the return after the URL. Wait, no, it's way too much. Can't do that. So the last one that I mentioned is Flux, if f.lux, I call it Flux. This is the thing that changes the color of your screen towards the nighttime, so you don't have like glaring blue colors at night. Do you use this?
I think I have something like this, but I've forgotten about it.
Is it turned on or?
Yeah, I think it does it automatically and I don't pay attention.
Okay, well, so I think some people hate this kind of thing. Some people really like it. I really like it. Like, if I were to switch it off now, I would probably burn out my eyes with the, because it's like 11 p.m. here.
It dims the brightness. Yeah, me and you are exactly 12 hours apart now. Opposite sides of the world. All right, so we're done with process tools. I can't imagine, based on your pickiness with those, how it's going to be now that we're talking about actual code and debugging tools. We could probably spend the next 45 minutes just talking about IDEs.
I don't think we should get too bogged down with the IDE thing.
I agree.
But I think we should probably maybe just run through the ones that are. I don't know why you put WP query there.
I think that was one of my Alfred shortcuts.
Brian had under the editors then a WP query variable, and I think that might have been your Alfred insertion.
So the text editors and IDEs that we even have listed are PHP Storm, Sublime, Atom, Vim, Coda.
Coda was there for old time's sake.
I still open Coda every now and then.
Oh really? To do some FTP edits or something.
No, I had a decent workflow with Coda, and I loved my color scheme that I haven't been able to replicate on PHP Storm. And there are a couple of things that are still easier for me in Coda than PHP Storm. But I had a syntax highlighter. I had a on-command PHP validator. I had a couple things that were decent features in Coda.
Here's basically the defining question for Coda, because, do you run Coda with a white background on your code?
Absolutely not.
Okay. Okay then.
I use a modified version of that green one, which I think is like solarized or something like that.
Oh yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And I've kind of mimicked that in PHP Storm now.
Yeah, so I use Atom at the moment. And I used Sublime before that. PHP Storm I've tried to get into so many times and I just can't do it. I think I really like much more lightweight editors, so more like a text editor for some reason, which is weird because I also, I really like all the language features of something like PHP Storm, like with all the clever autocomplete and all of that. Mm-hmm. And I always like try and make my text editors be more like that. But there's something about the rigidness of PHP Storm that I just can't seem to get on board with.
My biggest PHP Storm beef, and overall I think it's awesome. I mean, it's got a lot of stuff that's really cool, like it even analyzes your docs and stuff and like your inline docs and it does a lot of neat things. But my biggest beef is that it is so project dependent. Like it really wants everything you open to be so specific to a project, have all of the version control and stuff attached. And I just want to turn all that crap off because I really like hopping around directories and stuff and I might want to keep them up. All open in the same window or something.
Yeah, that's why I like a text editor quite often. It seems a lot more lightweight to do that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, it is. But, I mean, PHP Storm has some great features. Like, if you define a variable but then don't use it, it, like, grays it out for you. So it helps you kind of identify some things. And it's got better built-in tools for code formatting. So, like, you can automatically set it up to where it just understands WordPress's syntax rules, right. even the quirkier ones, like spaces between, you know, parentheses and single quotations and stuff.
Yeah.
Like you can program all of that into your settings, and that's really cool. And to my limited experience, otherwise, I never really got anything that was easy that way for Atom or Coda or anything like that.
No, like there's definitely no doubt like PHP Storm is the most powerful in its understanding of PHP. Like obviously it's like specifically for PHP, it's an IDE and they've done a lot of work to, you know, make it really understand the language. And it far exceeds anything that I've ever used in that regard, definitely.
I would be open to using Atom. I just am too lazy to try to set up Atom in a way that I like.
Yeah, so I've kind of like tweaked it quite a lot now. So I'd consider my setup to be pretty good.
Well, you created the syntax highlighter for Atom for WordPress.
Yeah, well, so I have the package for the autocomplete for hooks and filters. So my setup is basically. I have Atom with a couple of things. I have WordPress coding standards automatically like highlighting everything as I type, so it like shows any errors as I'm making changes. Also, I have a PHP linter which will show me like any syntax errors as I type. And then pretty much the only other thing I have is a there's one annoying thing for Atom is there's no good like PHP autocomplete library. There's only one that support that only works if your whole whole project is backed by Composer, so it can do all the auto loading and stuff to follow all the paths. One day I decided that I was just gonna like have a crack at writing my own autocomplete library from complete scratch, just as a bit of a challenge. So that's what I've got running now is like a full kind of IDE type package, which does all of the autocomplete. So like it's kind of like about 30% done right now. And I do like want to get it released at some point. But it's like a pet project of mine. But it's been pretty fun to like... build something like that from the ground up to like have like all the crawling and indexing of all the code and understanding it and what all the return types are and all of that. And then also the interactive side of whilst you're typing, what bits do you autocomplete at different places and things. So,
our ideas of fun are so different.
Yeah, no, this is me like on a weekend. I'm like, what should I do today?
Yeah.
Yours is like, you know, go and do something actually enjoyable with your life. Mine is like waste 13 hours on doing something like this.
I'm going to build a syntax highlighter.
Well, it's always one of those things that once you
mine's
know
like read
how
a book.
Difficult it was. Right, yeah, no, it's different lives, me and you, Brian. Anyway, so I'm pretty happy with my setup anyway, but yeah.
Do you feel like... Atom has replaced Sublime generally?
No, it's definitely not there yet. Like Sublime's performance is still, you know, years ahead of Atom really. But
that's kind of amazing considering it's maintained by one person.
Yeah, it's just like the technology is so different that it's really kind of built from the ground up to be fast, whereas Atom is built to be kind of extensible and pretty and good UI. Like the thing is like with Sublime, then you can't, like if you have an extension, you can't do custom UI basically because it's all native. Whereas if you're got an Atom extension, then it's great. Like you can just build HTML, JS, CSS interfaces that can have really nice stuff. So like my autocomplete stuff, you get a lot more flexibility with how you want to do that. You can like, you know, slide down a pop-up or whatever between lines that can show you documentation for that function. Like there's a huge amount of flexibility there, and because of that like it looks a lot more pretty. Like PHP coding standards that are shown for WordPress for me, then it can be a lot more visually nice with all of that stuff, or like the git diffs and git gutter and things that I have set up that shows me those changes. Like all of that is so much more pretty than Sublime, but unfortunately the performance is not quite as good, but you know it's not right. So bad for me. I know some people seem to either they experience like more performance issues or they notice them more than me. But
that's the other thing about PHP Storm. For an IDE, it's actually pretty fast. I've tested a couple of IDEs.
Once you boot it up.
Yeah, the boot takes forever, but it doesn't hog all your memory while you're actually using it. So I turn it off when I'm, you know, like about to record a podcast, but if I'm just have my IDE open all day, it's not that big of a hog on RAM. So let's get past IDEs. We could talk about that forever. Maybe someday we will. Although I will note that it's worth, and I'm the worst person to say this because I suck at Vim, it's worth at least knowing how to access Vim and then more importantly, quit it. It's worth learning how to quit Vim because every now and then you're going to want
to
SSH in and somewhat, you know, you'll have to open Vim to do something and it's good to be able to navigate it just a little bit.
Right. A basic understanding of Vim actually gets you very far. Like everything like afternoon 10% to 90% is incredibly difficult. It's probably going to take you about 3 years. But like just learn the first 10% and, you know, that's going to be really help you out a long way when when you accidentally type cron tab and it opens it in Vim and now you don't know where to get or you want to edit some file on a server, then like it's really useful.
Yeah, it amazes me the people that do all of their coding in Vim, though I don't understand it. But the people I've seen do that,
I didn't hear what you said, Brian. You just cut out for like 5 seconds.
I was just saying it's amazing the people that do all of their code in Vim.
Oh,
I mean, they're like wizards on the screen.
It's crazy.
So I want to move on to SQL Pro. This is a tool both of us use, and it's a database tool where you can both just view stuff in the database, but you can also, you know, run queries and all sorts of commands and log what's happening in the database. It's really powerful. I use it probably to the bare minimum. What about you?
Yeah, so I don't know if I use it to its full extent. It's pretty powerful, I think, for everything it does. But, I mean, I use it for, editing a lot of database stuff. Obviously, importing and exporting is quite handy for, though I often just use command line for doing that. But,
I've moved more towards WPCLI for import and export, but it's still significantly better than PHP MyAdmin for importing.
Yeah, miles better. One of the I quite often discover it has it's got a lot of like hidden little features that are handy. Like it's quite good for editing database schemas and stuff like that. Like it has a really good knowledge of all the different types you can do and like, I don't know, visually drag dropping, you know, the columns and stuff like that. And like, even I was doing something with on Nomad Base, then it uses like a lot of the geotypes for like polygons and things like that. And even for those, like you hover over the column and it gives you like a preview of the polygon. Like they've like done so much.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Stuff like that.
I don't know what a polygon is in relation to databases.
So MySQL has a type that you can store of like geography. So you can store coordinates in a field.
That's amazing.
So let's say you wanted to like store the outline of a city, like, you know, where the coordinates of that square or multi-pointed area is. So that's like a geo field, and you can hover over it in SQL Pro and it'll give you like a preview of that shape, like in
that's amazing.
Pop-up. So that's just one example of like how deep that tool is in terms of like its understanding of MySQL.
And it's got the benefit of looking like a stack of pancakes in your doc.
Does make you hungry every now and then.
So we both use that and like it. My most common use is just opening it up SQL Pro and seeing like, did the thing I just did actually do what I think it did? Just like straight up viewing the database. So that's obviously pretty limited in the way that I'm using it, but it's just a convenient way to manage databases. You yeah. also listed a MySQL command line tool. What do you use for that?
Just the MySQL client. So just, oh, okay. Like quite a lot of stuff. Like if you're happy using command line, then it's pretty fast. Like one reason that I use that is, if you're trying to open a WordPress multi-site database with like 50,000 tables, then, even like with SQL Pro or something, because it has to stat all those tables, and it can take like 5 minutes or something to actually unlock and, you know, display all those tables. But the MySQL command line just has a lot more options, so you can skip table statting and stuff when you open it up. So if you're, I don't know, it's fairly edge case, but there's a few situations where it's like it pays to be very close to the metal and just get connected to MySQL and run a query.
It's hilarious that I just now thought to even put this in the list, but WPCLI, obviously, we should have in this section. And that's more WordPress specific. But that's another
probably the most used tool for me, I think.
Yeah, it's high on my list as well. I don't know if it's my most used. Like, I'm not in it every second of every day, but I am using it more and more as I discover some of the cool stuff it can do. And I've also started to discover like custom WPCLI commands, which I haven't gotten into writing, but I've gotten into using. Okay. Do you write your own WPCLI commands?
Yeah, certainly. Like pretty much everything that I do that requires some administration task, like any migration command is always a WPCLI command. Like quite often I'll write debugging commands so I can like dig into production data a little easier. Mm-hmm. So I'll write like specific commands for, I don't know, let's say if I make a custom feature that is for locations or something like that. Like having a CLI command that allows you to list them and filter them and you know, run weird little scripts to find out where your problems are or whatever is pretty valuable. Yep. So like once you're used to doing it, then it's much more preferable to like writing a custom admin screen or something like that.
Yeah, I just used it. I ran all these commands and did the stuff through the command line. But Justin Sternberg actually wrote the custom commands for PostStatus, and he did a little project with me where I have these posts where essentially I call them footnotes, and it's like little one-offs in the newsletter. And they were all part of one post before, but in order to improve the searchability, I wanted to make that actually its own custom post type and convert the old ones. And we did that by looking for horizontal rules like HR tag in the content and then splitting those up and making them their own posts for a new custom post type. Okay, So Justin wrote that. But the way we implemented it was he created custom CLI commands for logging what was going to happen and then also showing confirmations that it was happening during the process. And then the conversion happened through WCLI. And then there was a new log for like after it was done, being able to, you know, see what was actually happening. So it was really cool to see the way you could do that in a custom development environment.
Yeah, it really allows you to be a lot more thorough, I think, with those kind of tasks. Like, there's a lot more, like, it's kind of standard, yeah, that you, like, add a dry run to your command so you can see what it is going to do, like, when you do run it. So, and then, like, progress indicators and bars you can do, like, in the command line and things like that. Like, you just get a lot out of the box, again, like, outputting for different formats, like JSON or CSV or table or whatever. So if you want to do other stuff with it, it's a lot easier.
There are definitely enough WPCLI benefits to where if I see a host that doesn't support WPCLI out of the box and they claim to do, you know, be supporting WordPress stuff, I just kind of yawn at that. It's just like you gotta have WPCLI on your host, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And then in terms of interfacing with WPCLI, we both use the same tool for that, but I'm sure you do more with it than I do. So why don't you talk a little bit about iTerm?
So this is a
terminal replacement.
Terminal replacement, I guess. Yeah. So the way that I have mine set up, which I think most people do, is I have it like on a hotkey and it slides down from the top of the screen. I actually fill up my whole screen.
No, I do not do that.
Okay. So, like, but for context, like, probably, oh, it's difficult to say. I would say literally 40% of my day is probably spent like this with full screen terminal.
Wow.
So, like, that's going to be different use case to probably what yours is. So, like, right now I have iTerm with, like, 20 tabs along the top for different things. So that will be, like, it's kind of like, so I have mine on control backtick as the open shortcut, and it pretty much just like switches my whole computer because it's full screen. It's like instantly switches to black and white terminal, you know, so that's kind of like the mode I'm in. And I quite like that big separation, like the kind of stuff that I do. Then I want a load of room for all of my terminal output and everything. Most of what I do here is like going to be either SSH'd into different servers and running stuff there, or like local build tools that are running via Grunt or Webpack and stuff like that. But
so we use it for the same reasons, but you use it more extensively than I do.
Probably, yeah.
I didn't even know you could have a slide down from the top set up. I have to dig around looking for it sometimes. I installed iTerm because I wanted multi-tab terminal and I wanted colors. Those are the only two reasons I wanted it.
Okay. So you're definitely a superficial user. I'd have to say, like, so am I. Like, if iTerm preferences is probably the worst example of any preference pane I've ever seen. It's incredibly complicated. There's probably over 200 options or something in iTerm. There's different profiles you can have for like different use cases, or, you know, what different shortcuts bound to different profiles. It is like so unbelievably complex and configurable. I feel like I probably know 2 or 3% of of the stuff there.
Yeah. This
another thing that I just discovered that is really cool actually is you can drag drop for panes. So if you have two tabs open, you can drag one of the tabs to like make it use like the right hand side of the terminal, so you have like multi panes as well as multi tabs, which is kind of cool, which is something you've always been able to do, but usually not via like drag drop, so it makes that really easy.
I just changed my background color to pink.
Okay, I understand the different different perspectives we have on this.
I think it looks pretty good. Maybe I'll make this my post image. Green looks good. Ooh, purple.
You can choose any color you want. So I mean,
I'm gonna make it like a deep purple. That looks pretty good. Is this gonna make you really sad when I?
No, not at all.
So yeah, I mean, iTerm's pretty cool. Even if you use it like me, which is very limited.
What here's something we didn't put in here, but do you know what shell you're using?
No.
Okay. You're probably just the default bash, is that?
Yeah.
So far as you know.
I'm
using a different one called Fish, which does some like amongst other things, it like I have quite a lot of fancy autocomplete stuff set up.
You can set transparency on iTerm too.
Yeah. You should see Noel's. He has like, so his is like semi-transparent with an image of like some crazy light thing in the background. He's like completely, he's like taken the terminal and like turned it into a designer kind of.
Awesome. There's also a blur, terrible, which I don't understand.
Yeah. That's kind of cool. Like blurs the background so it doesn't, like text in the background isn't going to.
Oh, I see. Oh yeah, I'm seeing it now. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
So I just turned on transparency and blur. So now I have a transparent purple iTerm.
Good stuff.
This is important. This is where people get the most opinionated.
I know it is. I'm pretty opinionated about Twitter, but then again, like I love it when I see somebody else with their setup, and I'm like, oh my god, what is that? I need that. So. That's one of my favorite things about going to conferences is seeing other people's so sad is seeing other people's setups so I can steal things.
All right. So I think this might be my most important tool in terms of trying to figure stuff out which it's a WordPress plugin by someone that works with you, John Blackburn, called Query Monitor. And this is like a WordPress query information overload tool.
this is like, I don't know, monitoring on steroids for your web pages.
So by default, any page load, whether you're in the admin or the front end, it adds kind of a snapshot glance at what just happened on that page load up in the toolbar, like how many seconds it took to load, and
It might have database queries.
How many queries?
Query time, I think.
And the query time, that's right. And then you can toggle that from the toolbar, and then it just unloads on you with
a million statistics.
Oh my gosh, everything going on.
It's worth saying that it's called Query Monitor, but it's not just database queries. That's like 1/10 of the total amount of things.
It also shows every hook that's firing on the page and which like methods are hooking into that. It shows, you can look at all the scripts and styles that are being loaded. You can analyze duplicate queries. You can
see where the queries come from, which is quite handy. You get a backtrace for each of the queries as well.
Mm-hmm. You can see which conditionals are returning true. So like admin or is blog admin or both returning true.
It has rewrites, like the match rewrite that's there, right?
Yeah. This plugin is definitely the one that will level you up.
The other cool thing about it is you can write custom modules for it to do other stuff. So I wrote one called Flame Graph. I don't know if you know what a Flame Graph is, but it like basically adds another panel to the Query Monitor section, which shows you like a graph of how long every function took. So it's like, it might not make sense to explain it audibly, but basically it's running left to right is your execution. So, you know, the left-hand side is when the script starts, the right-hand side is when the page is finished loading. And then in between is all of the different function calls. But then it stacks up vertically the deeper a function call goes. So basically, whenever you see wide peaks, then you know that something is kind of something to look in more detail. So in the one that I built, you can hover over any of the different blocks in this big flame graph. It looks like flames. That's why there's like peaks and yada yada. But anyway, you can hover over any part and it'll tell you like what function that was, and then you can see like what function is called through because the rest of the flame graph, and then you can go look up why it's being so slow. That was like one add-on that I made, but they're really easy to make additional panels for like different stuff that you might have that's custom.
Nice. This plugin is probably the most useful debug plugin you could possibly use. At the bottom of all the output that it offers, it also shows like a snapshot of your settings on your database, your PHP settings, the WordPress constants that you might want to pay attention to, server version stuff. I mean, it's amazing. So good.
Yeah, sometimes I put it on in production if I'm like wondering, I don't know why something's being slow, or like want to know something about the server or whatever. Just installing Query Monitor is really easy.
Yeah. I'd say that's probably the one that people, if they don't have of everything we're talking about, you got to get Query Monitor installed. So I think that's probably, do you have any last things you want to mention on
the
coding?
The only
tools?
Other, I'm going to mention quickly HTTPy. Is that how you pronounce it?
HTTPy.
Anyway, it's basically another command line tool. So it's basically a, alternative to curl on the command line, which is a lot more modern and user friendly. So like curl is pretty old school and it's, HTTPy is just a bit more like easy to pass different data. So like I use it when testing APIs a lot. So you can like send a post request to your endpoint and pass it some JSON really easily. And when it like gets the response, then it formats all the JSON in a pretty way and stuff like that. So if you use curl on command line, check out HTTPy because it's a lot more usable in my opinion.
Awesome. So we're going to take a break real quick, as always, and thank one of our partners. And our featured partner today is Yoast, and specifically the WordPress SEO plugin. WordPress SEO is the most popular SEO plugin on the market. It does a whole lot of stuff to kind of auto-format your page for search engines to pick up on, markup for specific things, and show all the fancy stuff in search engines, even like different ratings and micro data that might be interesting.
I think it also it does like OG stuff right for OpenGraph stuff and
OpenGraph.
All of those kind of things. I'm guessing like the Twitter ones, does it have that in there?
Yep, OpenGraph for Facebook, and then the Twitter metadata, Twitter card data, that's what it's called.
And I think you can like define all that stuff separately, right? So you can have like define a specific image for Facebook and stuff like that.
You can have a fallback image, and then it handles picking up the specific like metadata and whatnot. And I think it may even be on the roadmap to be able to customize it depending on where you're sharing something in the future, which is pretty cool. They just came out with version 3.2 of Yoast SEO. And the biggest thing is they introduced a help center that's on every settings page to help like walk you through how to do stuff on the different help centers. The primary thing I use WordPress SEO for day to day is if I just want to have a different title for my post when people view it on the front end versus what's in the search engine, because I like to have more like easy to read human titles that aren't necessarily search friendly when I'm actually writing something.
You prefer to load your titles full of
keywords, buzzwords. You know, if I want to say I'm reviewing Yoast SEO or something, I might make it in the search engine say like Yoast SEO WordPress plugin review. But on the website, I might say something like I'm a big fan of Yoast SEO plugin, which just is a little, you know, it's a little less
it's a different
ideal
context, I guess, if people
are
in the
title it's a different
on
context.
Site already.
Mm-hmm. So it's really nice for that, and it shows you the little green light if you are doing a good job, and I guess that's handy as well. And then there's a commercial version that you can buy that gives you support and redirects, which I'm actually using as my primary redirect tool these days, some other features that are pretty nice. So check out Yoast SEO and go to yoast.com for more on that, and thank you to Yoast for being a Post Status partner. Let's dig into build tools. So build tools are things that you utilize during the code process, but I guess also during the deployment process sometimes, where it takes your code and it runs some processes on your code or maybe your assets and turns it into something new. So this could be the two most common build tools are Grunt and Gulp. Most of the stuff that you can do with these, the other has a similar tool for it. Do you have a preference between Grunt and Gulp?
You know, I kind of don't. If I was going to use one, I'd probably use Grunt because it's a little more declarative in nature. But the more I do front-end build stuff, I'm actually using them a little less and less for whatever reason. I think maybe it was just like the way that I was using Grunt or whatever, but it seems quite easy to just like keep adding lots of stuff, and then it's getting quite slow when you're running Grunt Watch or whatever. Mm-hmm. So usually what I would do now, like for JavaScript transpiling and things, then I would just run like Webpack directly on the command line rather than using the Grunt abstraction again, because like it's a little faster if you're just using the tool directly. Same with like SAS, I would just use like SAS command line rather than running it through Grunt or something. But
can you watch on that, or do you have to do it on command?
Yeah, you can watch with that. Yeah, so the tools that I guess Webpack and SAS both have watching built in via some mechanism. And usually I'd just be like running either of those in two tabs. But like I'm not saying it's like the best setup. I'm just saying for like the stuff that I do, I'm not like doing loads of repeatable front end stuff all the time where it's like just easy to be able to type grunt. Like it's usually a bit more specific than that, where like, oh, I'm changing this specific JavaScript file. I know exactly that I need to do this little bit of compiling. So that's what I'll run. That's actually kind of more the direction I'm in with development these days, rather than something that's just going to take care of everything in one command. I don't really like that style so much, but works for some people.
I feel like Gulp probably has more momentum in the front end development world than Grunt does. WordPress itself uses Grunt for some WordPress build stuff, but not for like, not to the degree that you would do it with your, like doing your own theme or something like that. Right. I have always used Grunt until recently. I was playing with Web Dev Studio's Underscores fork. It's like their version of Underscores that they use for client projects. And they have both a Grunt and a Gulp file to do basically the same stuff. So you can do whichever one you feel like. And I used Gulp to play with it. And, you know, I had no problems with it. And I think it was a little faster than Grunt, or at least...
Yeah, I've had that experience too. And I'm not sure, is it just because like the Gulp things are just like people know what they're doing more there or something? I don't know.
Well,
I didn't
compare their Gulp to the, like, on... I didn't compare Gulp to Grunt on the same project. I compared Gulp to the way I run Grunt on PostStatus. So it's probably not fair.
Exactly. Yeah, but I've had exactly the same experience. And again, I don't know why. Like maybe it is that, but Gulp has always seemed pretty fast.
A lot of people like the way Gulp formatting is, like the way that you would set up all your processes or whatever. I don't really see that big of a difference between the two. Both of them are relatively readable to me. But I've screwed around with Grunt a lot more. So if I'm like adding new tasks to Grunt, I'm going to feel a little more comfortable than I would if I was doing it in Gulp. I know on PostStatus, the stuff I'm using Grunt for is basically just within the theme. It's not really site-wide, although you can do a lot of site-wide stuff with both of these tools. It's pretty neat. But I'm mostly using it for SAS compiling, auto-prefixing, some linting for JavaScript, CSS, let's see, concatenation. Doing language files is pretty cool.
Oh, yeah, that's cool.
You can make pot. That's what that one is. Let's see, you can do some style versioning. What else can you do? That's about it. That's about all that I use it for. But, I mean, you can do all sorts of stuff with these. I don't think I have a watch command on the JavaScript, so I usually have to build if I'm doing JavaScript changes, but you can set it up to where you're watching for both JavaScript and SAS.
Yeah, I'd say like for me, a lot of JavaScript I do these days, I'm doing like ES6 stuff, yeah, so you typically have to transpile that, whereas it might not be the same for you.
Another thing that people use these for a lot is like sprites and I don't know, some other stuff like that, and that's
like
a little more than I like
getting
into.
Optimizing images, like
optimizing images is a cool one. However, that's only useful for images that you're including in your project, which I don't like doing that with many images in the first place. Another neat one is SVG sprites. There's some tools to put that into a build process to where you can include individual SVGs and then optimize the way those are output on the front end with Gulp or Grunt. So that's pretty cool. However, I would advise if someone's not doing any kind of build processes, you're probably missing out on quite a bit. I feel like it's pretty much the standard now. Like if I just see someone, for instance, not using a preprocessor or post-processor, whatever their fancy is, then that kind of blows my mind in terms of how they're styling their websites.
I guess so. Like that's, I think there are reasons why you wouldn't want it, or reasons that might be valid for not doing that, but you should probably know why you're not doing it. So yeah, if you've never heard of them, then you probably want to look into it.
I could probably be convinced if it's like a majorly huge project and it's like really tight restrictions. But for your average like consulting or you know, your personal product website or whatever, then you probably want to be doing something like this.
Yeah, I think what I would say is if you're using like an app to do your compiling, like what was the popular one that came out? Like
CodeKit.
Yeah. I'd say like if you're using that, I'd definitely look into trying something like Grunt that can do that for you.
CodeKit like, really it reaches a lot of limitations once you start working in a team of any kind.
Yeah, exactly. Like when people are running different versions of it and it's having different output and stuff like that, like it's a lot better if you have your Grunt file as part of your project and you know everybody's running exactly the same thing that way.
It is if you've never used any kind of build tool, then CodeKit is a nice introduction to just start seeing what's happening. But it's probably not what I would want to run on like a serious production site. But if you just want to like dip your toe into the world of build processes, then I guess CodeKit could be a good option to try out. But yeah, for the most part, to me, it's easy enough now to take like a single Grunt file and adjust it across projects to where I'm not really doing a whole lot of like new configuration of my Grunt file.
Yeah. The other little tip I have for build tools is if you're doing SaaS, there's two ways or two libraries library is the right word for compiling. One is what is it called? The Ruby implementation, which is usually with Compass. So that's kind of like the more old school way of compiling SAS, which is really, really slow. So if you're using something like Grunt Contrib SAS as your Grunt module, or you have to have Ruby installed to compile, then I'd recommend that you look at Node SAS or Grunt SAS is the Grunt module. The underlying library is libsass, which is like a re-implementation of SAS that's running in C, so it's like about 10 times faster. So yeah, that's like there's a couple of pitfalls. One is that it's lagging behind, or was last time I looked, a little bit in the spec, but if you're not using really cutting-edge SAS things, then it's not a problem. And the other thing is it's much easier to run builds in an automated way if you're only using Node SAS with libsass, because you don't need Ruby and all of the Ruby modules and everything. So again, like under Windows and stuff, like it's a pain to have to get all that set up. But mainly the performance thing, like is if you're taking more than like 300 milliseconds to compile your SAS, like it's way too slow. It doesn't need to be that slow. So try Node SAS.
I don't even know what I'm using.
You should check your Grunt file.
My Grunt file just says SAS.
Check task. Your package JSON.
Yeah, that's where I'm going right now. I have it under git ignore, so it's not in my... I don't see it in the repo, so I'm opening my project.
You just... Brian's got to open up PHP Storm, so we'll recompute the podcast. <It's just finished.
laughs> No, I'm just opening up TextEdit. I am using Grunt Contrib SAS and it's freaking slow.
You should switch. That's your problem.
Yep. It's so slow. I hate it. It's like you save and then you just sit there for like 3 seconds.
Oh man, don't.
The level of non-optimization I have in my life probably would drive you insane if you just worked side by side with me for
exactly. I'm just imagining a day. Like looking over your shoulder and just maybe like you have your mouse sensitivity on like one or something and you're just like
I have to like pick my mouse up and move it across the mouse pad like 4 times to get across the screen.
You like those kind of like product promo videos, you know, where like the mouse just moves like really slowly so you can follow it, but that's just Brian using his computer.
Although because of this podcast, you'd be real impressed with my iTerm setup with my transparent purple background.
That's true.
It's gonna be a hit at WordCamps across the nation.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about version control, review tools, and deployment processes. At the base, from a version control standpoint, it's a matter of where are your repos. So, I think both of us are using GitHub only, right?
Yeah, apart from WordPress development.
Oh, right. Yeah, well, screw that. But from a GitHub perspective, or from a Git perspective, you could use GitHub for your repos. You could use Bitbucket. It's basically the same thing.
Yeah. Don't tell the fanboys that either way. GitLab is like an open source self-hosted GitHub, which is pretty cool.
Yeah, and you may have some client restrictions, I guess, that don't want you to have like hosted Git repos or something.
On that note, so we're having a fun discussion with a client at the moment because they have self-hosted GitHub, like GitHub Enterprise. And to access that, it's internally hosted, so they have VPN in their office, you know, that external people can get access. But they'll only let us have access if we use laptops that they supply us with.
Golly.
So we're trying to wrangle this to see if we can get access. So I don't really want to have everybody have to do development on a different laptop than their usual one. This is why, you know, it's pertinent to this conversation, like setting up your machine, how it works for you, and having full control over that, I think, is really important. But yeah.
Yeah, that's insane. That reminds me, back in a past life, I did a PowerPoint presentation in Oak Ridge, Tennessee, which is like the super secret, like, nuclear research area.
I won't ask why you're there then.
Yeah, don't ask questions. I could not even bring in a USB drive to their facility. So I had to email my presentation in like four parts to my contact, wow, who then put it back together after they did a security scan to make sure I wasn't bringing, wow, in something to spy on them. So, yeah, I mean, people are crazy sometimes. So if GitHub Enterprise, you need your own laptops. Back when I was doing client work on a team, we used Beanstalk for our client repos. So their repo and our deployment was all kind of on the same thing. I currently use DeployBot for deployment, which is by the same company that does Beanstalk, which is called WildBit. Cool company. And DeployBot is awesome. It manages the deployment, but it integrates with my GitHub repos.
We've used that before also.
Yeah, I really like DeployBot because I can set up my servers like production and staging and have settings for both. I can set up auto deployment to staging, for instance. So if I have it set to a particular branch, I can make a commit, which I use Tower for that. I'm just putting my whole process into one package and then you can do yours.
Yeah, it's fine.
So if I commit through like Tower, which is a visual interface for managing Git, then I can auto deploy it to my staging site, go test it, and then I can manually deploy to production if I want. And I can set up different settings for each and give different permissions to each and do all sorts of stuff. They also have something that's really cool where within the settings of a particular server, you can trigger webhooks. You can do your actual compilation or compilation. I've never said that before about
it works.
Yeah, you can compile, compress, do all sorts of stuff in the build in the deployment process. So you don't even have to have that code anywhere really in your local setups. You can run shell commands. You can do all sorts of stuff. It's pretty amazing.
I mean, you can basically, so I guess the basic concept behind DeployBot is you plug any repository into it, and then you can plug in any location to where it's going to push that to. If it's like Git somewhere else, or SFTP somewhere else, or any stuff like that.
Yep, and I really like being able to see the history from there. It makes rolling back to a specific commit really simple. I I cannot recommend a visual deployment tool enough.
We used it for I think we were hosting something on Pantheon, but because Pantheon don't support Git submodules, which we make pretty heavy use of, then we were basically just pushing everything to GitHub. That would then go to Deploybot, and Deploybot would push it, like would collapse down all the submodules and everything, and then push it back to Pantheon. So that's how we were able to work around that, which is kind of good.
Yeah, that's neat. So what is your deployment and Git process?
So anybody that's ever heard me talk about Git before will know that I love this tool called TIG, which is Git backwards. And it's basically
So it's the worst name ever.
It's the best way to describe it is it's a visual Git client on the command line, which is
text mode interface for Git.
Yeah, and it is fantastic. And I've probably only in my life ever convinced like maybe one other person that this is the best tool ever. So like, you know, maybe don't be surprised if you try it out and you don't like it.
I don't understand it.
So it's what's the best thing to compare it to? There's nothing quite like it. So on the command line, I run TIG in my repo, and that opens up in the command line still a full visual interface, all powered by keyboard for all of the change files. I can like stage things one line at a time, and I can stash things and all of this, but it's all incredibly cryptic.
S and then it stages the first thing in the
exactly.
list.
But the shortcuts are completely wild. Like these are not shortcuts that you've ever seen anywhere else. So then I press, so I'll like stage a few lines of a few different files, and I'll press Shift C to open up the command, to open up commit, and then to do the actual commit message, then it'll open up Vim, and I'll type in all of my commit messages in Vim, and then when I exit Vim, it automatically uses that as a commit message. So I'll like revert or stage in all of that, all my different parts there. Then what I do is just use Git on the command line to Git push like the branch. Then I use a tool called Hub, which is a command line tool that integrates with GitHub, so you can open pull requests from the command line. So I'll do like, so once I push my branch up to Git, then I'll do like hub pull request, and then it'll create a pull request for that branch, and I'll type in the message that I want the pull request to be in, and then I quit it, it will give me a link to the pull request. So then once it's merged, then it's going to, let's say I want to deploy it to production or something. So usually all of our stuff, then none of the built minified files are in the Git repository. So we have a build server that runs all of your like your grunt and things like that on the project. So when you issue a deploy, it's going to run all that and create all the minified files, and then it's going to push it out into production.
How do you roll back?
Typically, so I'm really not a fan of doing rollbacks in terms of like rolling back the deploy, but it's still in your Git repository. Like, so the way that I do a rollback is I revert the previous merge request and then do another deploy of the Git repository. So the Git repo, whatever branch is running in production, you know, let's say it's a branch called production, is always an exact mirror. So, because the problem is, like, quite often what you'll do is, like, gets to 5 p.m. and you push something and it breaks your website and you just click revert. And then, like, over the weekend, it's like you've got to tell everybody, oh, don't do deploy because, you know, the Git branch is broken or whatever. Whereas if you always make it so your Git branch is the branch that's in production and then you do your reverts by reverting stuff in Git, then you know that it's always safe to carry on deploying from Git. So that's pretty much my process. The only other thing I have is when I have pretty big merge conflicts, then I use a tool called Araxis Merge, and this is another tool that I've self-convinced many other people it's a good idea to use. So this allows you, you know, you have a really bad merge conflict, and it allows you to do three-way merging, and it's very... it's like quite enterprisey. Like the UI is like built on some like it looks like it's like a Java app or something like that, you know. So built with some like universal Windows-esque.
So ugly.
UI. It's really ugly. Like for me, like but it's by far the best merge tool I've ever used. It's really really lacks, like, all of the different panes are full editors as well. So, like, you can merge across chunks, but then you can make manual edits if you need to and things like that. So, I don't know. For me, it's, like, really, really powerful. Like, quite often what happens is, like, there's a pull request that's in a really bad state. And I don't know, like, I don't have a great knowledge of Git merging, but I'm the one with Raxis Merge, and I can always sort out any pull requests, no matter how messed up it seems to be. And I attribute most of that to Araxis Merge. So, yeah, that's...
I do my merge conflicts through Tower. It's got a pretty good interface for that, although I don't come upon a whole lot of merge conflicts because I don't work in a team that often anymore. It's possible that I have someone else that does something on my site, and then I screw it up or forget to do something, but
right.
The one that's built into Tower has been good enough for me, or I can work my way around it, which is the more likely scenario.
I think Tower...
Your tool does...
Sorry, carry on.
I was going to say, your tool does look pretty good for, like, if you have a more common need for fixing those scenarios. I will say, looking at the TIG manual, I already hate it.
You know what? I think like TIG versus Tower is basically the that just sums up the differences probably of how we use a computer.
Yeah, probably. I love Tower because I can scroll and see the history, and I press a button to stage things. I love it. It's great. Yeah. Every now and then I've run into issues where figuring out how to do what I would need to do and get through Tower is a little beyond me. So I look up how to do it. And anything I do directly in the command line with Git reflects obviously in Tower. So it doesn't matter, I can go to the command line anytime I need to, but for the basic, make changes, pull down, push up, whatever. Like, it's super simple, switching branches, even all that kind of stuff. It's so visual and easy that...
I do get that, but like, for example, I have I guess I'm not totally sure how you do it there, but let's say I'm trying to think of something that would be quicker. Like, one thing that I have on command line is when I push to the origin, you want to create the branch doesn't exist yet on the origin. I don't actually know how this works in Tower. Maybe it's really easy, but I have some shortcut set up for doing stuff like that that makes it much quicker, but I'm thinking
create the new branch while you're committing it.
Yeah. So the git command is like git push dash u origin and then the branch name again. So you have to type the branch name twice, which drives me insane because you can't, it's not a command that you can always run like twice in a row. So I've got like a shortcut which gets the current git branch and puts that into the command, but I'm thinking in Tower, then maybe that's just automatic to do something.
Let me ask you a question. How often do you create a new branch for a repo in a day or a week or whatever?
I probably create about 10 or 15 branches a day.
And therein lies the difference.
Okay. Our use of these things is so different, I think, that it's difficult to compare.
I might create a new branch once every week or two.
Okay, so I'm presuming that when you commit any code, you're not creating pull requests for that.
No, not often. Okay. I'm normally committing it to the branch and then merging the branches.
Right, okay, yeah.
Now, if I'm committing to someone else's project, then I'll do a pull request. So yeah, sure. If I'm doing something with someone else's project, then I guess I would be creating a lot more branches. But I just don't do that very often. I'm much more often just open an issue on someone else's project and let them figure it out.
Classic. Yeah, yeah. So I've got plenty of those repos of people done that to me. I don't fix them very quickly, so I'm presuming that it's the same.
People need to figure out what works for them, but these are some of the tools we use. Obviously, what Joe is talking about is probably good stuff to look at for doing the type of work that they do, hardcore, everyday, in code all the time type of tools.
I wouldn't even say that, it's just kind of the way that I prefer it to be. Like, there's other people in HumanMade that do just the same amount of development and all of that, but are just, happier using more, visual tools.
I mean, like, I think that a visual tool is good until you're doing something so often that the command line driven tool becomes second nature. Right. But for me,
I love TIG so much because it is visual still. Like, it gives you like red and green for all of your different deleted and all of that kind of stuff. Like, I can move in as TIG pretty much as quick as my brain can think what I want to do. And I don't feel that way in Tower.
Yeah. That makes sense. And I don't have that need pretty much at all. Not for deploying code, at least. I feel that way about some other things that I do, but not in this particular scenario. Right. Okay, so let's finish up with a section on front-end tools and extensions that we use. So some of these are even web apps, but some are like Chrome extensions or stuff like that. The basic one is probably the Chrome Inspector. I feel like everybody uses that.
Yeah, unless you don't use Chrome. Then it's Firefox DevTools.
Then I'm sorry.
And if you use Safari DevTools, just stop. Stop doing that. just put down your computer right now.
This is one of those things where I know that, I mean, I'm in the Inspector every day, a good bit of the day. Yet I'm using it so minimally compared to what I see resources on, and what people are doing. There's some amazing things that you can do through Inspector for analyzing and adjusting your code. I personally use it mostly for, observation more than interaction. Do you do a lot of interaction through the Inspector?
So in terms of design stuff, not really. Like I've had it set up before, so like when I'm changing like CSS properties, then it's like saving those to files and compiling and stuff. But yeah, broadly speaking, like if it's HTML or styles, I'm just like inspecting stuff and looking, and then I'll like tweak the file in Atom and have live reload or reload the page or whatever. Like, that's my workflow there. But with JavaScript, it's definitely a lot different. Like, I use the interactive debugger very extensively with JavaScript.
Do you have any tools? If people are interested in being able to do that, is there like a resource that you know of to help someone with it?
I'm not sure. I would probably start. So if you're like, my kind of initial JavaScript debugging was like console.log, everything. Mm-hmm. You quite quickly, like, it's a bit more difficult doing console logs in JavaScript because it's event driven. So like it's more difficult to trace where things are coming from. In PHP, it's all just more linear, right? And when you var dump or error log, it's quite obvious how it got there or whatever. JavaScript doesn't quite work that way because you can have a lot of things happening at once. So the pretty much like the thing that unlocked the power of JavaScript debugging is this one word you can put anywhere in your JavaScript called debugger. Just put that in your JavaScript. Like, whenever you want to know what is going on, and what happens is, as soon as the JavaScript interpreter gets to this statement debugger, it's going to pause, and then it's going to allow you to like inspect the state of all of the variables and everything at that point. This is like this kind of like quite drastically changes how you see writing and debugging JavaScript is when you're using it in an interactive way, which you can do in PHP too with something like XDebug. But JavaScript, I think, is especially useful to kind of get to that level where you understand like breakpoints and things like that, because the event-driven nature of it is so much more kind of crazy in terms of how many different things can happen, you know, at the same time, and how difficult it is to trace it and know what state your variable is in at different times. So JS debugger statement is, you know, a good Google term if you want to check that out. We'll put some links. Another really cool thing that they just added to the Chrome Inspector is the Secure tab, which has got a huge amount of debugging information for HTTPS pages.
Yeah, so I'm really looking cool. I'm looking at that right now. So you can actually see that the certificate's valid. You can view the certificate itself, see where who it's issued by, when it expires. It's pretty cool. And then you can see it has origins under the domain. So like on PostStatus, it's got, you know, the main origin for poststatus.com, but it's also got like stats.wp.com for WordPress.com's stats. Mm-hmm. And you can see their certificate, and you can see the one for my font delivery source and Google Analytics and Facebook and all sorts of stuff. I've got a lot of crap running on here. You can see the one for my CDN. It's interesting. Yeah, I haven't played around too much with that, but that's neat. I use the network tab a good bit to see just performance-wise how I'm looking. Always hop into a incognito window when you do that and do hard refresh to start up. But when you do, you can get a good look at like your time to first byte, your waterfall of like how stuff is loading on the website. Those types of things are really useful.
I'm usually using the network tab for more like looking at specific requests and the response and request headers for those different requests. And another really cool thing you can do is, well, you can right-click on any request and replay it. So if you've done an AJAX request and it's like five clicks to get to that AJAX request in your UI, once you've done it once, then you can just right-click and keep refiring it if you're like tweaking your PHP on the back end or something, which is kind of cool.
That's amazing.
And another kind of a crazy thing you can do is you can right-click on any of your requests and copy as curl command. So then you have like a exact command of what that is to paste into your terminal and start tweaking things. So again, like that's quite often what I would do with that is like, this is a fairly specific use case, but let's say you have like 10 different web servers running your code and one of them is acting funny or something. You could like grab the curl command for it and then run it specifically on one web server via SSH or something. And that means that you can like target the exact one you want, or you can like, you know, tweak cookie values and things because it's all just one curl command that you can edit. So that's a pretty esoteric feature that again can be pretty useful.
Yeah, that's really cool. I'm looking at that right now. I'm not even using this to a significant degree, but I mean, sometimes I just like to see like, you know, if I'm getting a weird 404 or like if I want to, I've had to do this with typography sometimes, like if different services will deliver like a 302 response, you know, like you can kind of just go dig in how something, especially third party stuff that you're pulling into your website, see what the hell it's doing. That's always useful. You can also sort based on the type of stuff that you're pulling in. Aspen, I look at the network tab a good bit. That's usually where I do my like front end performance analysis initially before I run it through any kind of tests or anything. You can also preserve the log, which is kind of cool if you have stuff that's like continuously going on in that single view.
I never used that, but I just had a thing earlier where I was like trying to test something that when you like reload the page, so I was like logging and trying to like stop the script to see what it said, but I should have just used the preserve log, obviously.
Yeah, that one's pretty cool. Let's see. I don't think there's any other big stuff that I am using.
The only other thing that I've mentioned in relation to this is there's a really good, if you're doing anything with React.js, there's a really good add-on to the Chrome DevTools that adds like a React.js tab, which shows you like the layout of all your components instead of HTML tags, which is really useful because you can also tweak like the props of your components and it all renders live and everything. So if you do anything with React, definitely get the add-on tools for that.
And actually two other things, and people may or may not, you know, even realize this stuff is there. It's one of those things where you're like, how did I not know this existed, you know? But you can, the very top left button is like to select an element on your page. So if you want to inspect a specific element, it helps you like go straight to that within the elements panel. And then obviously, if you want to do poor man's mobile testing or device testing, then you can set the what are those things called? You can trick it to thinking it's an iPhone or what are those called?
I think the dimensions. What do you mean?
No, not a dimension. I'm just brain farting.
I think they recently added like a it also does like speed throttling, I think, as well. And you can change your pixel ratio and stuff like that.
Yeah, I'm just talking about more of like how stuff looks.
Right.
Oh my goodness, what is the term I'm trying to think of?
Media queries? Is it something to do with that?
No, because it's not sizing information, it's device recognition. What is that?
Oh, user agent?
Thank you, user agent. Goodness gracious. I need to just stop for the day. So it spoofs the user agent so you can at least do some poor man testing. So that's really helpful. And then, the main thing I do is I go and I screw around with styles and, add new rules and basically test the stuff that I'm playing with or toggle the state or whatever while I'm doing front-end development. That's where I spend most of my time. And also, this has been on and off for me, but every now and then, the inspector will recognize actually the SAS file where something's coming from. So if I'm...
Oh, yeah, yeah. So if you compiled with a source map.
Yeah.
Something that we didn't mention, but...
but if you do... Sometimes you can actually find out exactly in the SAS file where, where a change was made. That's really nice.
You can also... you can configure the dev tools to also hook into if you're running like Grunt Watch or something. So when you make a change in the inspector, it'll actually do the Grunt build and then reload the SAS file in the Chrome dev tools. So you integrate it into one? Like your full workflow. So that's in the settings and it's called, what is it called? It's kind of tricky. So there's a section in the dev tool settings enabling CSS saw maps, and then it also has an auto reload generated CSS. So basically when you're running Grunt Watch and it changes those, then it'll auto reload it and bring in your new source files for SAS so you can see the changes.
Yeah, I mean there's so many cool things in dev tools that I just don't even know where to start. And I don't utilize near enough of it. There's some people that do, that just know it inside and out.
Yeah, again, like the profiling and paint and stuff like that is another area that
paint really times. You won't even know what a paint time is until you have one that's bad. We had a client project where we were doing some blur stuff over images and... Oh my God, it just made horrible lag and paint time issues. And that's when I really dug into paint times, but the dev tools really help with that. I mean, there's all sorts of things in there. I want to give shout outs to a couple other extensions that I use. These are pretty basic. I'm going to give three really simple, but extensions that I use all the time. Pindles or Web Developer, they're both basically the same thing, but essentially it's like this little toolbar, and then you can use it to do stuff like outline every heading on the page or outline block level elements or turn off CSS or disable all cookies or disable JavaScript, like just straight through this little tiny interface, and that's handy. Another one I use is for IP and domain information. I think that's literally the name of the extension. It's pretty boring. It shows you like the network, the DNS settings, the domain information, ISP details. So when I'm domain stalking, I use that one a lot.
You used this one on my website, I think.
I did. That's where I used it, on your website, on a podcast live one time. And then another one for website stalking I use is Wappalizer. It shows up in the address bar on any website that I go to, and it gives me details about the website that I'm looking at. So if I go to WordPress.org, it pops up with this little WordPress icon, and that's the tell of the CMS that it's using. But when you open that up, it also shows like that WordPress.org uses Google Analytics, that it's on Nginx, that it has jQuery and PHP and Gravatar and Quantcast all in there.
I think I used to have that or something similar. Like Built With, is that a different one?
Built With may have a similar tool. I'm not exactly sure. This may even use Built With actually within its setup. But like if you go to PostStatus, you can even see that this is on my logged in view, so it's showing like Backbone, it shows WooCommerce, it shows Yoast SEO. It shows all sorts of stuff.
Just to when you're perusing Netflix, you're like, oh, look at that.
See what Netflix is running.
Right.
So I really like that extension. So those are probably my three most used extensions. Do you have anything you want to give a shout out to?
I'm not really using much like dev extensions for that stuff. I have some like really quite odd ones. Like I've got one called Force Cores where you can like edit the cores headers. So if I'm doing like some weird JavaScript, I want to make cross domain AJAX calls, then you can like fake it with that. Nothing like you, I don't think. I've GA Debugger, that's kind of a useful one for Google Analytics. It'll like output all of the Google Analytics events and all of that kind of stuff into your console. So when you're kind of trying to debug GA stuff, it's useful.
That's cool. I need to check that one out. Another extension that's pretty handy for API stuff is Postman. It's a endpoint analyzer, I guess. So like you can put in any, I think it picks up based on any URL, like what's happening and analyzes the query. So you can interface with a REST API through Postman. And there's a lot of tools for that. What do you use for that kind of stuff? Like if you're...
I usually use HTTP Pi, like I said. So again, I'm just...
Oh, okay.
I want to test something. I'll just like open up command line and type in the URL of the endpoint and then type in the data that I want to send to it and the basic auth and, you know, press enter.
Okay.
I definitely used to use more tools, you know, GUIs for this kind of stuff. And I feel like the more experience that I get, the more like specifically niche thing that I know that I need to do. And because of that, then the command line for me works quite well for that. But I'm not sure if like the things that I'm doing now are just not as like serious or in depth, so I can just get away with using the command line for those things, or is it like I just can pinpoint exactly like what I want to test in my API endpoint that I'm building, that I'm just able to get to that point easier by having some command that does it. I've definitely noticed a trend more in like the way that I use a lot of the tools that I have. They seem to be like very more specific small tools rather than big apps for stuff.
Well, I like Postman, big app and all.
I think actually I did try and open Postman the other day, but it just crashed. So then I was like, well, there we go.
Well, that happens. Let's see. So that is pretty much everything I have on here. Oh,
yeah.
I got a shout out for CodePen on here too, just because if you just want to toss some code into an editor, and if you're okay with just HTML, CSS, and JavaScript, then you can make a pen and see the preview real time and share it with someone. So that's pretty cool. Work so well for like anything with PHP in it, but CodePen is getting more and more advanced in terms of what all you can include, and like You can do React stuff in CodePen now, for instance, and it can compile SAS and do all sorts of things. You can basically build an entire website in CodePen.
Might not be recommended.
I don't know. It's a pretty cool app. But yeah, it's a good front end tool, and especially if you're sharing stuff and wanting to show people things or debugging some front end stuff, it's really nice. But these are our tools. We are way over time.
Yeah, wow. We've I just feel like we should apologize, or I don't know.
I don't think anybody really is surprised.
It might be because it's getting late here, so maybe I'm slowing down more than usual. I don't know.
Probably. With that, let's call it a day. Where should people go to follow along with you?
Follow me on Twitter. I just am on like 1,007 followers. So
is that all?
Yeah, Twitter sent me a notification to let me know that I had 1,000 followers. So
they send you a notification for that?
Yeah.
Wow, you have 1,012 followers.
Oh wow, God, I've been rolling.
You only follow 82 people. I feel like privileged.
Well, I'm one of those lists. Weird people that reads all of their Twitter feed. So the if somebody's like tweeting too much, as I've got to unfollow them. It's just like I can't do that. Or if they're like, so I feel like, I don't know. I feel on one hand like maybe you're just meant to like follow everybody because that's just what people do, and then you just like, I guess how most people
then you stop using it.
Well, maybe, or you just like, you like open Twitter every day and you'll like read, you know, a couple percent of your tweets because you're not going to go through all of them. But that's it's not how I use it anyway. But I don't know how ordinary that is.
For a long time, I limited myself to following 300 people, and I read every tweet. And
that's a lot.
Now I follow 525 people, and because I feel like I need to follow more people in regards to keeping up with WordPress stuff, and I still read almost every tweet, but I'm much better at scrolling really fast and scanning. So if I know it's just a bunch of the same type of thing, like the hottest news of the day type of stuff, or just big conversations that I'm not interested in, my eyes have learned how to get past it pretty quickly. I don't miss much. If I'm following someone, I'm seeing pretty much everything they're saying.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like you're like when I tweet quite often, you'll interact with it, which must mean that you're reading most stuff.
Yeah, I definitely, my outbound tweets are definitely like probably 5 to 1 or 10 to 1. I don't know, replies. Someone could test me on that. But I'm pretty annoying on Twitter probably, but whatever.
Well, you don't tweet too much, so that's...
I don't tweet too much for you. Probably for some people, but I always tell my personal friends, sometimes I'll find out they're following that account, but I have an account that's for personal stuff where I complain about Alabama politics and Auburn football. And
I don't think I follow this account.
Yeah, probably good for WordPress people not to follow that account, but it amazes me when personal friends I find out are following my at Krogsgard account because it's all WordPress stuff.
Yeah, they must be just like, why are they?
I don't know. That's what I ask them. When I see, like, every now and then I'll see like a favorite or something from a personal friend. I'm like, what are you doing? Like, what's wrong with you following that account? Like, that is an unfollowable account for a normal human being. Right.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like mine's like that because it's just like, I need to get better with Twitter. I think I need some social media strategy.
You need to practice your Twitter.
Yeah, I think I should probably sign up to some kind of webinar.
Oh, I really want to put on a Twitter webinar now. How much can I charge for that?
I don't know. You might have to exchange it for Facebook shares or something.
I don't know. I'm going to bill for it. All right, let's get off this podcast.
Okay, yes.
I have nothing else to pitch.
Where can people find you?
At Krogsgard, I said so. And go to poststatus.com/club and join. Give me your money.
There we go.
All right, bye-bye.
Thanks.